I'm going to stand up, if you don't mind. I'll sit down when we get in the discussion.
Is that all right?
I just can speak better standing up and be heard. I wasn't going to do this, but I think I will anyway. Let's get some of the words before us. You referred to the Declaration of Independence. We pretty well know those words, but when I try to recite it to myself, I don't quite get them straight, so I'm going to read that. This is the second paragraph. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, etc., etc. That's the theological note in the Declaration of Independence. One could have a long discussion, and I'm not going to launch into it, as to the theology of the founders. That's a complicated subject. But more important for tonight, the words of from the First Amendment. Congress shall make no law representing an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Very brief. Doesn't say a whole lot. Well, it does say a whole lot. It says something that turns out to be quite huge. And it was historically a huge moment in history when a government and a country was founded without an established religion. That was a new thing. There's so many facets to this subject. We've got 10 minutes apiece here. What to grab hold of, what to accent is a major problem. So I'm going to squeeze things down and just talk about one or two points that to me are most relevant right now under this big theme of church-state separation. And this point may not be what you came to hear about, but it's what comes to mind when I'm asked to talk about, when I was asked to talk about this subject. I certainly believe in church-state separation. But I have a great concern that many people in our time understand separation of church and state to mean the separation of religion from political and social life. And indeed, the cry, separation of church and state, has been used and is sometimes today used to say to religious people who want to make their influence felt in the social political sphere, oh no, that's not your sphere. You can't tiptoe into that area. The opponents of the abolition movement back in the 19th century said this quite often. Most of the abolitionists were religious people. They were believers. They were Christian evangelicals, most of them. We wouldn't have had, well, who knows what we might have had otherwise, but it's hard to see how we would have had any time that soon unless there was a passionate belief in segments, at least, of the religious community that slavery was a sin, not just a contradiction to the Constitution, not just a violation of a good custom, but was a sin, and that God required that we cleanse the country of this sin. And it was that very explicit religious conviction that drove the movement against slavery in this country. Some of the opponents of the abolition movement objected. Oh no, you're talking about politics and economics. And that doesn't belong in the religious sphere. Got a nice quotation here if I can find it. Oh, here we go. This comes from George Armstrong, a pro-slavery pastor of a Presbyterian church in Norfolk, Virginia, explained that Christians, whenever their views on slavery itself should oppose, whatever their views on slavery itself should oppose abolition, because economic and political arrangements are not the proper business of the Church of God. The Church, according to Pastor Armstrong, is not intended to do all the good which needs to be done in the world. He added, God has assigned to the Church and the state each its separate province, and neither has ever intruded into the province of the other without suffering therefore. Another little piece of history on this very point. A historian by the name of Mitchell Schnee has shown, tells a story of the following. In 1854, a coalition of 3,000 New England clergy presented a petition that opposed on religious grounds the expansion of slavery into the Nebraska Territory. Pro-slavery members of the Senate were aghast. Religion, they contended, should remain in its proper place. And senator after senator spoke up, waving the flag, separation of church and state. Well, my point is clear, I think, that whatever that phrase means, and it means some very important things, it should not be taken to mean separation of religion from life, of any sphere of life. We've got a special problem in the Christian and Jewish tradition particularly, which are the ones I know. I can't really speak about the others, which claims that God is Lord over all things. And that means that God and the kingdom of God transcends the nation. And if people who believe in that kind of God are convinced that something is wrong, they are going to confront the nation. Now, sometimes we cheer that, depending on whether we like what they're crusading for, and sometimes we bemoan it if we don't like what they're crusading for. Maybe the best thing I can do is to talk just a few moments about my work with the North Carolina Council of Churches. Much of what we did when I was with the council, and they still do it now, is to try to bring religious convictions to bear on social political issues. And in the mid-90s, the Council of Churches adopted a series of five guidelines for church-state relations or for a religious approach or attitude toward government and politics. I'm going to read you just two of those guidelines. The first two, they are the most important. These are still in place, so far as I know. I don't think they've been amended since my departure. Vigorous involvement in political causes and political activities are a vital aspect of Christian witness in the modern world. We're commanded to love our neighbor. If we're Christians, if we're Jews, maybe if we're something else, we're commanded to love our neighbor. And that entails being concerned about the conditions in which the neighbor lives. If we're concerned about healthy communities, if we're concerned about health, if we're concerned about education, that means bringing our religious convictions to bear on the political order. The statement goes on to say, in a confessional tone, often when Christians have entered the political realm, they've fallen into sins of fanatical self-righteousness and dogmatism. These sins must be guarded against. The more common sin among our ecumenical and mainline churches and synagogues, too, I'll bet, are the sins of indifference, apathy, and hopelessness. We must especially guard against these sins and constantly renew our faith in a God who promises salvation and promises to be with us in the struggle for justice and for peace. No territory is out of bounds, from this perspective at least. A second guideline is this one, and it's sort of the flip side. While Christians and other religious people should participate in politics with zeal, we should carefully avoid prideful self-righteousness and dogmatic certitude. Now I see people nodding. That's what worries us today. That's what worries people about religious folk getting involved in politics. Because so often when we do that, it has been with the stance, we have the whole truth, we know the whole truth, God is on our side without question, without doubt, 100%. Now, I have to confess there's some issues about which, in connection with which, I pretty much feel that way myself. I'm pretty darn certain that God was against slavery and against racial discrimination and racial injustice and so on. Nonetheless, from a monotheistic point of view, there's only one God, and that God can never be equated with any particular political or social program. Those are two pretty good guidelines, I think, that help us in thinking about church-state relations. I'm particularly concerned about these things these days because I know and I sense there's a lot of hostility out there, just much of it justifiable, about religious participation in politics. Particularly among probably folks who are here tonight with the exertions of the religious right. Do you know this book, American Theocracy, that Kevin Phillips has just come out with? He's a rip-roaring writer, and when I decided I should take a look at that book in preparation for this subject, American Theocracy. His thesis is there are three things that are taking us to hell. One is the oil, big oil, the consumption of oil and the power of the oil lobby. Two is the debt. And three is radical religion. I asked myself, why did he title the book? Why did he put the word theocracy in the title? And only the words oil and money in the subtitle. Well, because it's a hot topic today, I think it'll help sell books. But I think he overstates the case. I think if he really knows what theocracy means, that he exaggerates quite a bit. It's a reasonable fear. We fear that dogmatism. We fear that rigidity. At the same time, we can see it more clearly in the other person. Under the rubric of separation of church and state, if we applaud when certain segments of the church champion, let's say, racial equality, which was a movement surely driven and empowered by religious sentiment, and then someone comes along, or a large group comes along, and wants to pass laws against abortion, we say, that's not fair. It's time to wind up. So let me try to think of a concluding sentence. Well, simply a concluding incident. In the 1950s, the Roman Catholic bishops were concerned that legislation be defeated which would require racial segregation in private schools. And they threatened to excommunicate legislators who would vote in favor of requiring racial segregation in private schools. And none of us at that point said, uh-uh, that's violating separation of church and state. Those who knew about it said, that's great. That's wonderful. Church is on the ball. It's struggling for justice. Those same bishops in another time have a perfect right, disagree with them as vigorously as I do, and maybe most of you do. I think we have to stand with them and say, okay, that's the name of the game. You can't outlaw any group, and certainly not outlaw a group just because it's a religious group, for pressing its views, for flexing whatever political muscle it can flex in legitimate ways in this advocacy. Well, I got to go. That's time. Time's up. But that's my main one point.